Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, this is Scout Smith, and this is Down South and Dirty. This morning, we're going to talk about the art of persuasion, the lost political art in cancel culture. It's interesting that in the Democratic Party, we talk about having a big tent. We talk about tolerance. We're supposed to be the party where everybody can come along and get together. And that is true in some point, particularly when you look at our platform, the things that we believe in, the things that we fight for. But when it comes time to getting elected, and putting people in office, we have a tendency to forget all of that and we throw it out of the freaking door. When I first came into Democratic politics back in 2008, as a Republican convert to the Democratic Party, I can actually say I was welcomed with open arms. And people genuinely were glad to help me make my transition, teach me what it was to be a Democrat, and persuaded me to follow the tenets and philosophy, files who we are as a party. I don't think it'll be that easy today in 2020 if I was a young African American man who had been a conservative and not even really a conservative, but just being a, because I've never been a conservative, really, to be honest with you, I've never been a conservative. I've always been a progressive. And I talked about this on RTL the other night. I've always been a progressive. A Teddy Roosevelt progressive. I believe in capitalism, but I don't think companies should get so big that they can control the wheels of government. I believe that we should work hard on protecting our environment so that we can enjoy the fruits of our world when we're not working. And I also believe that when it comes to foreign policy, we speak from a position of strength. Regardless, if I may not want endless wars, but I'm not going to not fight just for the sake of saying I'm not going to fight. We can talk about it all day, but if it comes down to me having to take, if I was the president of the United States, I would always choose negotiation first. Even as a party official, I always choose negotiation and mediation before, you know, doing things that are punitive. But plead that I have no problem with going the punitive route if there's no way to find reason and logic to solve a problem. One of the issues that we've had, you know, this is one I think a lot of people have come into politics because of the things that have been happening over the last 12 years. And we do a very poor job of teaching civics in the United States. We all have these urban legend type theories of how government's supposed to work. Very few of us understand how Western democracy and how republic work. We don't understand the history that allowed certain elements in our government to exist. And we take and we pass along information that is half truth and half fiction. And we make it canon. And this is not just the average layman or the voter. This is the political expert. These are the political scientists. These are the pundits. These are the operatives, the elected officials. We also contribute to passing along some of these false narratives about how our government and our elections and the culture that we have politically actually operate. I stated on a Facebook post the other day that the biggest problem is that we don't know how to use the user interface of the program or the app that is America. We, you know, how many friends you or even yourself, when something pops up on your computer, you just click, 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 click. And then the next damn thing you know, you done opened up some ransomware, some virus, or you done signed up for some shit you didn't mean to sign up for because you just didn't pay attention to how the user interface was directing you. You wasn't paying attention. You didn't learn how the program operates. Let's talk about it. In the description, I talked about how many districts around the country prefer not to only run one Democratic candidate in their primary, and that how this system is not rigged, it's actually a tool to survive. And where we particularly in races where we know we're going to end up facing Republicans, we have learned, and this is kind of a shame because we know our people. Some people don't like primaries because what happens is that in contested primaries, Democrats split into their factions. And a lot of folks don't like to think they have different factions inside of the Democratic Party. There's more than two. There's more than three. And even those factions have sub-factions. Okay? You know, everybody likes to jump on to the fact that, oh, you get every Democratic candidate talking about their progressive. Dang, that goddamn many progressives in the Democratic Party. Okay. There are three, in my opinion, main groups in the Democratic Party. Factions, I'm going to call them. There's a faction of people that we particularly don't like to talk about, but they exist, and they are fiscally conservative, socially moderate Democrats. We call them blue dogs, conservative Democrats. These people, like I said, are fiscally conservative, so when we get talking about programs, they support them, but the first thing they're going to ask is how we're going to pay for it. Because, again, good governance says that there must be an accountability for the funds that we're spending. So we have to pick and choose which programs we're going to fund so that we remain efficient and be able to get done what needs to get done. You know, and these same people are a little bit more beholden to traditional values, but however are tolerant of those people who do not subscribe to traditional values, but don't think that non-traditional values need to be leading the way. Then we have the neoliberal / liberal. They may not care as much about policies as much as the conservatives do, but they will also ask questions about, okay, how we're going to pay for it and what we're going to cut. Now, they're probably going to want to cut anything that has to do with regulations. You know, they're going to, you know, let's cut out anything that we're going to cut stuff that the Republicans like. We're going to look at defense spending. We're going to look at, you know, how do we increase taxes on the upper classes to be able to pay for what we need to pay for? And are there anything that are just not working that we can possibly get rid of? They are a hell of a lot more tolerant of non-traditional value systems and believe that these non-traditional value systems need to be integrated into everyday society. Still may be some limitations on what, because, again, stability is something that they cherish. And they will fight for it. Then we have the progressive. The progressives want to see change. Some of it is, a lot of it is about putting more programs in place to help those who are being left behind by the current system. It's not about replacing the system, it's about adding more people to the system. Okay, how do we create more business owners? How do we get more workers with a working wage, with a living wage? How do we increase the educational opportunities for those who have been lacking educational opportunities? How can we level out and increase the chances for positive outcomes? How do we integrate non-traditional value systems into traditional value systems? How do we build common respect for one another? Then we have the socialists who want a complete upheaval of the system because the system is broken and bleeding. The workers need a say, regardless if they are willing to take the risk. And traditional values need to be wiped away, and there needs to be a new system all together. Now, what has happened is you've had the neoliberals and the socialists infiltrate the progressive movement. because there's no way they're going to get into the conservative movement. They don't want to. But progressives have a good platform, and majority of people support progressive policy. They want to add more. They don't. Most people have conditioned themselves to the system and want to be added into the system. More people want to become members of the workforce. More people want to become small business owners. Most people believe that big business stifles and attempts to hold back innovation just for profit motive. And let's get this understood. And this is something that deals with this cell situation. When we talk about faction, because this goes into why the art of persuasion is being lost. But most people do not understand that the reason the big oil companies are not immediately pushing for green technologies, why they're not on board with the Green New Deal, isn't that it's about greed. It's about work. How many of us like to go to work every day and there not to be no major issue? You just go in there, you do your job, you go home, you collect your freaking paycheck. How many of us like when we have to change procedures? How many of us hate when there's something that we've been working and using for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, and all of a sudden we have to learn something brand new? When you are an expert at the system and the way it operates today, and now you have to learn something new and may lose your position as an expert because they're going to be new experts. This is why. It has really nothing to do with greed. It has to do with basically human beings like their comfort zone. We understand fossil fuels. We understand, you know, how to produce it. We know how to distribute it. We know how to price it. We know what it does. This green energy stuff changes things. There's going to be, it shifts paradigms. Now, true enough, there's just as much money to be made in it as it is in fossil fuel. More so even. But now you got to change the infrastructure around you. You have to go into uncharted territory. So they know this day is coming, and they have invested in it, while at the same time trying to maintain the status quo so they can continue to make their money. Some of you will get it, some of you won't. Some of you think, that's the easiest shit I've ever heard. But in actuality, each and every, most of us do it in our regular everyday lives. And we do it in politics. As a progressive, I want to see the little guy have a chance. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm a person with an entrepreneurial spirit. I want to be able to go into business, make money, possibly employ a couple of people, a few people, dozens of people. Hopefully grow my company into something larger. And I don't want the big guys in my way. As a podcaster, it upsets me every time I see somebody on NBC or CNN or something start a brand new podcast. They have the resources to enter this medium and stifle independent competition. But then at the same time, if I was to grow my podcast enough to be extended an offer by a larger brand to join them, I would have a decision to make. Do I remain independent? Or do I give my crew an opportunity to expand itself and everybody to be able to eat at the table and have that opportunity to be better? These are the questions we asked ourselves inside of the Democratic Party. It every day? How do we give, how do we provide an environment to have opportunities for everyone? Not just for some people. So with us having four different factions attempting to put themselves in a position of supremacy, we have to have, do we have to have a battle royale, or do we persuade people that our particular faction is better than the other? Well, what we have done is decided we're going to go into battle royale. We can see it very clearly in our presidential preference primaries in the United States today. And I've personally seen it because I've, you know, I've been running around doing a top five for the last, you know, damn year. And it finally came down that, hey, I had to choose one because we really was down to being to the point of choosing one. And when I chose my pick, because it was different than what I did last time, because I left the comfort zone that everybody was used to be being in, and being predictable about what I was going to think, what I was going to say, I got attacked by the same people who believe that I should have the right to be able to think freely, that I, as a black man, need to have my voice heard. But then, because my voice is not speaking the words that you want to hear from me, I'm uninformed, I'm dumb, I'm selling out, all kinds of negative connotations by me making a decision for myself and even for my family that is counter to what you believe. I've not attacked not one of my friends for remaining loyal to their beliefs that Bernie Sanders should be the next president of the United States. I understand why you're where you are. I respect where you are. I understand that your journeys in life have allowed you to form opinions, things that are different than mine. I also understand that most of you are unwavering in your support. However, you know, there are millions of Americans who don't know who they really want to vote for. And they're sitting back watching us right now going, how can I make this decision? How can I pick a side? Because I don't want people to think negatively of me. I don't want people to talk badly about me. I just want to go vote. And let my voice be heard. But if I do that, somebody's going to attack me. And I don't want to be attacked. I ain't voting. We'll stay at home. All of these people are smarter than me anyway. They know better. They're figured out. But, and that's what's happening. We're not persuading people to our side. We're convincing folks that this is a shit show. They need to stay home. It'll sort itself out in the wash. And it's not going to sort itself out in the watch. because every cycle we leave these people at home because we don't tell them other than, oh, you need to vote. It's your right. It's your duty. You need to vote. And you need to vote like you've never voted before. But we don't convince them, nor attempt to persuade them on how that vote is going to change lives. We don't explain to them that they have choices. We don't attempt to persuade them that whoever it is that we're supporting is the person they also need to support. What we do is that we tell them that the other person isn't worthy of their support. We never talk about the positives of our person. We talk about the negatives of the other person. So, going back to the original thesis of this show, when we are running candidates on the local level, this discord sometimes plays itself out in our down ballot elections. And so you have county parties that are literally holding unofficial nominating conventions before there's even qualification. Okay, we don't need two Democrats running because they're gonna split the vote. We hear it a lot in the African American community, particularly in nonpartisan races. Oh, we're gonna split the vote. Not that we're increasing your choices, but we're splitting the vote. We need to pick somebody now. But we have we sit down in back rooms and then we sit back and we have phone calls. None of this, and let this be understood, none of this has anything to do with the freaking DNC. DNC ain't got that kind of power. But there's people, and a lot of the times, these are not even official party conversations. It's not that the chairman of these county parties is sitting down having this conversation. It is the elected officials and other community officials who are having these conversations without even necessarily saying anything to the Democratic Party. They all know, but they just know that if we got this person running, this person running, this person running, that we will end up fighting each other. And at the end of the day, whoever loses is just going to stay home. And if we're operating in a situation in which the Republicans also have mounted a candidate, we just lost some people that we could have turned out in the jungle. So we have these conversations in the back, and we come up with one candidate. That candidate is usually viable and raise money and is a consensus candidate. And like I said, the actual Democratic Party apparatus in that county may not even understand, nor even know, or may even not even been added into the conversation until the end. Because what people fail to realize, there's a good reason for why there needs to be multiple candidates sometimes in these races. But the party is a money maker. The more people running, the more qualified fees. The more qualified fees, the more that goes into the county coffers, and that can fund voter education, you know, GOTV programs, this, that, and other. If we can, you know, just get people into a civil environment in which they can talk about the issues and talk about how they're going to govern without it becoming battles of personal ego and splitting us into camps. And people saying from the beginning that if I am not the nominee, I am going to support whoever's up here is running. I'm just giving you a choice. Let me tell you why I believe that I'm the best choice. Without saying, it's okay to draw a contract and say, well, you know, I believe in X, Y, and Z, and my other opponents don't. And then allow the other candidates to say why they don't support that position without saying anything negative about the other person. Well, so-and-so doesn't support X, Y, and Z because, you know, they sold out because they own a business and And that could be possibly, that could be it. It could well be it. But we make it in a personal attack as if that is a negative reason for why we don't support something. All of us support something or don't support something based on how it's going to affect us or affect our community. And a lot of people jump into political races based on something that happened to them. You have way too many people that have jumped into races because of something that has happened to them in the street. You know, there's a candidate, and I'm not going to speak any names. This is just an example. That when they first came into politics, it was because there was some really messed up regulation about how people in their industry were licensed. And they built a whole political mantra around this issue. Now, this person today has expanded their political wheelhouse. They are running for higher office. But they came into the game in particular because there was some screwed up regulation dealing with the licensing of their profession. And it just didn't hurt them. It hurt thousands of others in the same profession who then it made it difficult for them to feed their family. This industry wasn't a very large industry. It usually does not end up employing thousands upon thousands of people at a time. Most people in this industry work for themselves singularly and maybe at points of time have maybe three to no more than five other people working with them at any point in time. So it's not a big impact on the community, but this is why that person originally got into politics. And that's not easy. Because the only way it was ever going to get fixed is somebody who understood the problem to get in there and start fixing the problem. But we use it as a personal attack, as a person being selfish, not realizing that there's usually people just like this person and other areas of the state, of the city, of the county that they're in. It's just interesting. But what we do is that we don't like to have more than people in because we know that we're going to fight. And that at the end of the day, it ends up suppressing votes. And this is not the way it should be. What should be happening is that we're opening up and allowing people to run and allowing the voters to split their votes if they choose, and that if somebody can get 50 plus one, they win. And if two people come out of the top, out of a multiple field, that we have a runoff election and we fix it. Or even that one day we might get the right choice voting and so we can eliminate runoffs. But I never want to see clarity voting because that means somebody can win with less than, somebody can get 25% of the vote or 35% of the vote and end up being an elected official without the majority, without most of the people even having a say. Ranked choice voting would probably be the best idea for that. And it would allow us as Democrats to be able to get into the situation without worrying about splitting the vote. We are going to really have to look at how we talk about our candidates. How, and then once we learn how to talk about our candidates, how to be persuasive once again, then it makes us actually more competitive in a general election cycle. Because we have to understand that particularly for those of us who are operating inside of the political environment as operatives, as elected officials, as party officials, that we live inside of a bubble. There are things that we see, things that we hear, conversations that take place around us that inform our decision making. But how do we translate what we know into a message that says, hey, vote for my person. Vote for our party. Vote for our idea. Because I get Medicaid for all. I get making education affordable. I get all of that, but some people don't. A lot of people don't. There are people with different opinions. And in some places, they outnumber the people who are pro all of the way. So the question is, do you force your opinion down their throat, or do you maneuver yourself into governing a group of people and giving them what they actually are asking for? Or are you answering their question to alleviate fear they may have about your position? And that's a big thing, because a lot of things that we choose not to support come from a fear standpoint, is that I'm leaving a comfort zone. For instance, let's talk about Medicaid for all, single payer health care. Most millennials and Gen Z do not realize that there was a time in America when you could receive free health care. I think most of us Gen X's have forgotten about it, because, you know, American memories are short. We have short-term memory loss issues. Most boomers may remember this time, because it was like this. Everybody remembers the county hospital? The county hospital was funded by the county, the state, and the federal government to provide health care to the masses. You also had numerous religious orders that supported hospitals that gave health care to those who were unable to pay. And then you had those hospitals which were the rich folks' hospitals, and you knew what hospitals those were, and you paid to go into those. And the healthcare was different. For me, I remember growing up in DeKalb County, Georgia. I was born in Fulton, raised in DeKalb. I had what we call a Grady card. My mother had what we call the Grady. Grandmother had it. My father had it. My whole family had Grady cards. It was it was very easy to apply for. All we had to do was go down to Grady, fill out the paperwork that showed that we were residents of either Fulton or DeKalb County. Because we paid an extra bit to our sales tax that supported Grady Hospital. Because Grady Hospital used to be known as the Fulton DeKalb County Hospital. And it was named after Grady. Yeah, y'all were talking about who Grady. It could be probably named. Probably change. But I could go down to Grady Hospital, get any type of health care that I wanted, and all I had to do was present my card. Now, the thing was, I remember that any time we went to the hospital, that was probably going to be a full-day event. And it was so much of a full-day event that the hospital was geared around, you're going to have to be down there all day. So, on multiple floors, there were different vending areas, not machines. There were places where you could go, little convenience stores, you might want to say, that you could go buy things to eat, a little place, because you couldn't eat in the waiting room, no eating in the waiting room, no eating in the waiting room. But there were little places you could go eat. There was the cafeteria, which had biscuits. There were McDonald's. There was no McDonald's. There was an actual cafeteria that served up healthy choices. Now, we don't think about this today, but I remember this. The probably, you know, the I used to love the little lemon day thing, and that pretty much was, if you read the box, which I read everything growing up, there was not as many chemicals in that stuff as the stuff I see today. It said, you know, it said lemon concentrate, it said water, it said sugar, and then it said something, and that was for, you know, pasteurization, and that was about the extent of the chemical. Okay, and you sat down, and instead of watching Maury Povich or Judge Judy on television, there were constant educational videos about the respiratory system, the circulatory system, your endocrine system, and how you remain healthy. How do you keep yourself from getting the common cold? How do you maintain a healthy eating habit? It was all of this stuff. That was government health care. And you sat down the vast majority of the day to go see a specialist. You know, even if you had a 1 o'clock appointment, you usually wanted to be there by 10 because you had to go through all the different registration processes to make sure that you were supposed to be getting help in the Grady system. That may be different today because we would all be on the one national system, so everybody in the country that's supposed to be able to get this. But I can understand that if you lived in Fulton County or DeKalb County, you didn't want nobody from Cobb or Clayton or whatever to come in to the hospital and get your free service. Now, you can still come to Grady. You just don't have to pay. So we had to shift through those who were Grady system people and those who were not. And there were plenty of people who were there who were not in the Grady system because some of the best doctors in the United States and in the Southeast were still at Grady Hospital. So people would come in. And so, therefore, yeah, you know, it was a long wait because you had those who were Grady system people. And you had people who were not in Grady system, whatnot. And it was still, the health care was more affordable than if you went to Crawford Long, one of the other hospitals in the city. So we jump forward. By the time I was in my 20s, Grady had started moving toward a for-profit system. Because it was the largest hospital in the area, and that we had to serve more than just the citizens of Fulton and DeKalb, it was becoming a burden to be able to support these people. Maybe we should have been trying to expand the Grady system then, but again, you have people who did not want to pay extra taxes for health care. but were willing to pay out of pocket for it. This is why we have a healthcare issue, because some people would rather pay out of their pocket than pay tax. Still is true today. There are people who would rather feel like they get a better service, a better product if they pay for it. How do you persuade people from that mentality so that you can get a full-fledged single-payer healthcare system? Because people who vote remember sitting around their county public clinic waiting to get seen, knowing that I could get quicker service, pay for it. That was used to be, ooh, I got health insurance at my company. Ooh, I can go see Dr. So-and-so. Ooh, he gets you in and out of there. But this is a reality. I want to see single payer, but how do we convince people they need to surrender their comfort zone for that? And we have people who believe that, okay, let's integrate a single-payer system, allow people to still be able to keep their private insurance so that they can feel comfortable about this transition. And some of you are saying, screw the transition, screw people being comfortable, let's just do this. And you're not allaying people's feelings. Because you just believe that you're right. Let's look at the next issue. Affordable education. Most people will be, you know, having free public college for 4 years is not a bad idea. You know, there are a lot of communities in which you can nearby go to school for free already. If you live in Troup County, Georgia, you can go to West Georgia Technical College for free. Once you get, you can get hold to the Pell Grant, you can nearby go to school with no student debt whatsoever. I know this, I've seen it. I know it to be true. And, but at the same time, the person who goes to the, who aspires to go to the private institution is going, well, why can't my college be free too? Or the person that aspires to go to this school who doesn't want to go to the community college, they want to go to UGA, they want to go to Tech. Because a lot of this comes off of, you know, prestige and you know, showing off the Joneses. Let's not act like we don't want to show off the Joneses. I'm saying that I can pay for it. There's a lot of that in America. Don't act like it ain't. And then you got the people questioning, well, how are we going to pay for that? Now, we all know how we're going to pay for that. We're going to raise taxes. We're going to make some cuts on some other programs. Let's be honest. Let's have conversations about it. Let's continue to have conversations about it. But let's not just call people stupid because they're asking questions and they're questioning you on how you're going to do it and you can't explain it because you don't want to tell them something that is truly uncomfortable. And in the art of persuasion, sometimes you have to have uncomfortable conversation. Like, I'm very pro foreign policy with a strong military. Now, if we're going to start talking about cutting defense spending, I'm going to have a lot of questions. So where are we cutting defense spending from? Okay. What does that look like to get, you know, free college education or whatever we're looking for? Where those cuts come from? Because what we fail to understand is that, okay, let's say I want to cut 3 aircraft carriers from the military budget. Well, I'm going to tell you, the first people to fight you on that are going to be the people who live in Virginia, particularly those who live around Newport News, Norfolk, Portsmouth, Suffolk, Virginia Beach, Hampton. That whole congressional district is going to fight you. That congressman from that congressional district is going to fight you. Everybody in that area is going to fight you. Because one of the best paying jobs in the area is at the Newport News shipyard. The only place in America where you can build an aircraft carrier. Those people make great money. I used to work there when I was in the Navy. I was based on an aircraft carrier. Those guys, it provides those people with a wonderful standard of living. Great benefit. Union job. So then you're going to have the unions going, hold on, steel workers, pipe fitters, riggers, electricians. Hell yeah, the IBEW up in that joke called Big Show. We're talking about 3 aircraft carriers is almost $100 billion worth of industry. And then you talk about all of the other peripheral stuff that drops off, steel mills, aluminum fabricators, the people who make the wire, all the store owners who have stores set up outside of the doggone shipyard so that when the workers come out, they go buy their lunch or gas or whatever. All of the built home builders who build brand new houses for the young shipyard worker who had just graduated from his journeyman program with the union, who was getting ready to buy his first home. To all the guys and women who work at Lockheed Martin, who work at Boeing, who are going to build the aircraft, the 90-plus aircraft that are going to be on board that aircraft carrier, the people at Sikorsky, who are going to build the 5 helicopters that are going to be on each aircraft carrier. The folks at Northrop Grumman, who are going to build the E-2s that are going to be provide early warning. The guys at Raytheon, who are going to provide the missiles that are going to defend that joker. Those jobs then spread outside of Virginia into Georgia, Texas, California. Satellite states with large councils in the Electoral College. So when we get to having these conversations, are we going to really be able to cut that spending? It ain't that none of us really want to go to war. We really don't. We don't want to use the shit. But we like building it because it makes good jobs. Maintaining it provides good jobs because each one of those aircraft carriers, every 5 or 6 years, goes back to Newport News Shipyard for a complex overhaul. So there's new jobs. There's more jobs. And that's the only place on the planet that can do the work. So those questions have to be asked. But nobody wants to have that conversation because we really don't want to delve that deep into it. We want to make it quick and one-liners, and it's easier just to attack everybody than to have real substantive conversations about the things of our nation and the wheels and the gears that make it move. that we can have these things. We just got to be willing to have the hard conversations, again, to allay the fears of the change that it could bring about. Because at the end of the day, regardless of how much change human beings talk about it, we particularly really do not like change. That is one of the laws of power. Is when you talk about radical change, you can talk about it all day. But when you get time to implement it, you better be real incremental with it. Because people do not like culture shock. They don't like system shock. They don't like their stability to be screwed with. Just like I was just talking about, you know, the Green New Deal. Whoa, would I love solar energy? You know what I would like better than solar energy? Zero point energy. That's some real green shit for you. Because there are technologies that exist that we, all of us, have smothered that can provide large amounts of energy with very little work to over large distances that could change the way we live our lives. The question is, nobody can figure out how you're going to make some money off this shit. It's just like the Tesla. It's just like Tesla wanting to broadcast energy. We know it's possible, but the question is, how do you control transmission and distributorship, which is the way you make money? That goes into the argument that socialists make, that capitalism is an evil because it keeps innovation, it keeps certain things from happening. But at the end of the day, the reason why distribution and transmission becomes important is because there are jobs attached to it. There's infrastructure that's attached to it. And so again, at the end of the day, people have to work. People have always had to work. Whether or not it was in the beginning, the only thing is that over the last 10,000 years, human beings work a lot less than they used to do. Because it used to be that the average human being spent almost 12 hours a day trying to provide the calories just to survive. And that was each and every human being on the planet. And that probably at that particular point in time, that probably wasn't even a million of us on the planet. But over time, we learned that certain groups of people could now produce the food. Other groups of people transported the food. Other people then sold the food or distributed the food. Other people then cooked the food. And it gave those other people freed up time to learn how to do other stuff like invent the wheel, build cathedrals, pyramids, which then had to have people to build them. And then we had to have ways to feed the people who were building and making all this infrastructure so we could have this thing called civilization. Interesting concept. This is why persuasion is key. Because we have to be able to have conversation with people. We got to be able to educate them. We got to be able to talk about the hard thing to get rid of the fear. Because in this particular election, people keep saying, well, we got all these wonderful policies and all y'all are worried about is beating Trump. That, and I will be admitted, that is because I've put aside my want of Medicaid for all right now, for there to be affordable education right now, and for us to fight climate change right now, is because I have a fear of what 4 more years of Donald Trump will look like. We've seen what he's tried to do and what he has accomplished already. Can we afford to him to be able to have one or two more picks on the Supreme Court? No, because that's a lot. Think about how much has changed in America by the decisions of the Supreme Court. That in itself is an existential threat. But we're fussing about whether or not are you going to support the policies or not. There will be no policy But you could convince me with that, okay, look, we understand that your situation is we need to beat Donald Trump. We agree. Let's beat Donald. Let's do what we need to do so we can beat Donald so that we can get this stuff. Now, me personally, I think Bernie Sanders understands this, but his people don't. And your supporters and your surrogates are the people who are out there pushing your message. So as a candidate, you have to be very careful about the people who are speaking on your behalf and what they say and how they say it. Because at the end of the day, I can't listen to you when you're calling me stupid because I don't believe what you believe. Well, I'm not, or I'm scared, and so you're trying to make me feel bad because I'm scared. Instead of saying, hey, let me talk to you. Let's help reduce your fear. Or let me listen to you and understand what your true concerns are. And if you are a supporter and you're having these conversations, and particularly if you're a supporter who is actively involved in the campaign, and you're talking to people and you're finding out that you're coming across this on a regular basis, start gathering up the data on that and take it to your campaign, to whoever you are interfacing with on the campaign. Give them raw data. Because that helps you target better. It helps you put out a message that is persuasive to get the win. That was a campaign that I worked on. And then again, I'm not going to say any name. But I was going to door, I was knocking doors, and in a particular community, I kept hearing the same thing over and over and over and over again. It was not on our script. We didn't have any point, or we didn't have any way of being able to record this data. But what I started doing is I started writing on my list. This is before minivan. Yeah, millennials, there was this thing called minivan. Some of y'all see it every once in a while, the paper, had check marks on it, the whole nine yards. Yeah, it was crazy because you had to enter this data. And this is why boat builder sucks from back then. Y'all have no data from back then because we weren't putting that shit in. It's crazy. Particularly if you was on a small campaign, just didn't have time. We wrote down beside these people what the issue was. And then we had a board in our campaign office where we tracked that issue. And then we sent the candidate who had an answer to each one of those doors. That candidate won handily. And particularly in that district, he was able to go in there, talk to people, and reduce their fears. Somebody understood it. He just listened. And they asked him what he think he could do about it. And he gave them an honest answer. Not just some canned political answer. This is what we have to do if we want to win. We got to start having civil conversations with each other. We got to have the hard conversation. And everybody keeps saying, well, hey, but, you know, for us here in Georgia, we got 3 weeks. Before we pick who our presidential preference is. But we got, is it 8 weeks now? Till the May primary to convince people, particularly in races where we do have contested races, and they are there, and some people are mad because they are contested races. We got to have conversations. Some of these people are running because some of the people who are in office haven't done a damn thing. Some of them are running because they are ego tripping and they just believe that they want to be an elected official. Oh, and those people have got, if they want to even have a remote chance of winning, there's going to be about persuasion. Because why should I take and choose you over the person that has represented me for the last 8 years? I don't know who you are. And going in and talking about the other person like they ain't shit is not going to help you because, come on now, you come to the door talking to me about somebody like they ain't shit. I'm wondering, well, hell, why are you telling me? Y'all know how it operates in the hood. Y'all know how it operates in here. If you guys, if all you can do is come talk to throw shade, then you shady. And some of the people who are shady are the incumbent, but they ain't got to worry about it. They're already in office. They good. It's only if they ignore the situation that they got challenging, will they end up getting tapped out. They also have to persuade people that they are still the best choice. Talk about the experience. Talk about the votes that they've taken. Because I know, again, I worked for a candidate. This one, I can speak his name because he's retired. Representative Carl Von Epps, District 132, out of LaGrange, Georgia. I know that many of the people in our community had issues with some votes he had taken in 2010, 2012. Particularly, this goes back for a lot of us who remember the Stacey Abrams campaign in the primaries and how we were attacking, talking about education, votes that were taken about education. First, Stacey Evans was going all about this bill that they had been passed. This goes back, harkens to this issue. All of us had, and Democrats have had hard votes in this issue. And so I had the bright idea that I was going to primary Representative Von Epps. But being that this was the political culture at the time, I went and sat down and I had a conversation with him. We talked about the fact I wanted to primary him. But my question was, why did you take this vote? Now, that's a smart-ass reps in the House today that will tell you that that was their vote, and they voted how they felt they needed to vote. If you ever give a – if any of your elected leaders ever tell you it was their vote and they're going to vote, you run against their ass. You raise money. If you have to $5, $10 they ask their opponents to death, you do it. Because it is not their vote. It is your vote. They ought to go there and represent you. They don't have a personal fucking opinion. Carl broke it down to me, though. He said, I voted in what I thought was the best interest of the people here. And he broke down issue after issue that it would have affected in our community if he had taken the vote in another direction. He explained it to me. I ended up going to work for that man. Instead of primarying him, I went to go work for him. He persuaded me. And then that allowed me to go out there and work and help persuade others to reelect him. And he continued to do the work of the people of our district. And I did that twice under the mentorship of Ruby Elbasha, who is a phenomenal, phenomenal political operative in the southeastern United States, and taught me so, so much, and particularly about the art of persuasion in the field. And we were running in a district that had been redrawn to perform 70% Republican. And that district today is still held by a Democrat who is the minority leader of the House of Representatives for the state of Georgia, Representative Bob Trammell. we still hold that seat. And we're going to fight to hold that seat in 2020. Why? Because we're going to continue to persuade the voters of 132 that the Democratic Party is the best way forward for them in a district that is drawn for 70% Republican. So we have to ask ourselves, have we lost this art? Are we just going to continue to cancel each other and suppress our own vote by doing so? Are we going to continue to run around here and say, I'm a fucking smarty pants, I know better than you, I'm more intelligent than you, follow me? Because I'm going to tell you, that shit comes from so many points of privilege that it's sickening. It comes from positions of male privilege. It comes from positions of white privilege. It comes from positions of the boule privilege. Oh, black folks, do not act like we don't have privilege, because some of us are boule as hell. Members of the talented 10th, and we believe that we speak for the whole of us without listening to the whole of us. We're still running the same battles of the Atlanta Compromise in the African-American community today, almost 110 years later. And don't even know why, because we're not paying attention. But at the same time, because of that history, we understand that certain votes have to be taken a certain way. Now, it is the job of people who don't believe that to persuade us that that is no longer a way we need to continue to think. And we also need, and those who believe that we need to continue to think in that way, need to also sit back and tell the history of why we vote the way we vote, why things are done the way they're done. Because I'm going to take a moment here to tell a little story. I almost want to take and do Bedtime Story by Slick Rick. I wish I had it queued up. I was sure. You know, once upon a time not long ago. Hey, y'all know the song. But in this particular story, we got maybe about 15 minutes left in the show. And then I'm going to leave it be. We keep hearing everybody want to keep bringing up the 94 crime bill when they want to attack Joe Biden. And I'm finna preach to y'all right now. And I'm gonna get this. Y'all fixing to get this. Everybody voted for it. Okay? You got African American representatives who are in this House of Representatives who have been there just as long as Joe Biden. You got senators. Well, there ain't too many. There ain't no African American senators in the Senate this time. But for that to become law, the House of Representatives had to vote on their part of the bill. Get this, they supported it. And we ask why. How many of you who are millennials can raise your hand and remember 1994? Okay. Gen Z, you wouldn't even hear yet. So let me tell you about the late 1980s, early 1990s. We had this thing called crack that was running amok in our damn neighborhood. Now, you know, the story is that the CIA brought that shit in up. Could be, don't know. And when this shit hit the street, not only was it highly addictive, and it fucked up a whole bunch of lives, but that shit was a money maker. And because it was such a money maker, being that it was an illegal drug, the regulations that govern regular businesses that would have made sure that certain market territories were protected. You know that you had trademark and copyright protect. All that stuff that takes place in regular business does not exist in the drug trade. So when somebody wants your market, they just don't go in there and advertise, you know, and talk about how their product is better and this, that, and other. No, they come take your shit. They come in there and they kill you. They rob you. They'll crime other crimes that are committed. And then there's periphery crimes around prostitution, theft. Which, you know, every time you attempt to rob somebody, there's a possibility somebody's going to get hurt. So if you wanted some crack and you couldn't afford it, you wanted to go steal something to go sell so that you could get the money so you could go smoke your crack. Or if you were a woman, you wanted some crack, you decided the best way to use, you know, you got a nice body, you know, you find all the fellas trying to hit on you anyway. So, you know, let's not be this, let's not act coy now. This is down south and dirty. You know folks will pay some change to do something strange. So you go do that, you get some money in your hand, go buy some crack. So now you got other crimes building up around this one thing. You got murders taking place. You got robberies taking place because, hell, you got guys, you got people robbing the prostitutes of their money. You got the pimps getting robbed for their money. You got pimps then robbing other pimps. And all of this stuff is going on. Why? Because people want the money that is flowing through these neighborhoods illicitly because of this one scourge called crack. And in the 80s and 90s, we had a really, really bad habit about applying violent pressure to situations. Now, we understand that, you know, to keep those type of things from happening, you got strong economic programs. If you do some, you know, addict, if you treat the addict, if we do some educational prevention, from people touching the shit from the get-go, if we just go in there and we do all the soft power things that we can do to alleviate the economic pressures in the neighborhood that prevent people from seeing this is the only way they can make money, then we can reduce the crime. But at that point in time, we didn't understand that. And we not only had our elected officials who were promising to do some shit about it, we had our clergy who was pressuring them to do stuff about it, and our other community leaders pressuring to do something about it. We were protesting that shit in the street. We were prepared to fight the drug dealers our fucking selves. So they came up with a very harsh-ass crime deal. It put thousands upon thousands of us in jail. Millions of us in jail. Not just for selling crack, but some of the periphery crimes that went alongside. And some of those crimes were based on the fact that these people were addicted to a drug, and we did not see fit to treat them. But that is the way we looked at it back then. And it just wasn't a white racist idea. It was something that black people supported because we got tired of watching our children dying on the streets. We got tired of drive-by shooting. This is why so many people in the cities are anti-gun. But then at the same time, why so many of us are pro-Second Amendment? It's a very complicated situation in which a lot of hard conversations got to be had. This was not just about white people trying to put black people in jail. There was a war going on and people wanted it to end. And the people who were living in it wanted it to end. And they actually praised the shit when it fucking happened. But then we now, hindsight 2020, we see the repercussions. But I don't think anybody should apologize for trying to do what was right based on what we thought would work back then. We did the best we could do. We know better now. We do better. And I think the vast majority of our elected officials, including the ones who may have voted for this shit back then, understand that. But they are not going to allow you to sit there and tell them that they did something wrong based on what they were looking at the time. Because at the end of the day, crime in the United States is a hell of a lot lower than it was in the late 80s and early 90s. We can all agree on that. Because we're scared as hell to go out there and do some shit. Stop and frisk is no different than the shit that our boys did in damn Iraq. You're looking for the fucking terrorists. You go kicking in everybody's fucking door. Now, true enough, it makes you an enemy. But that's what you do when you're scared. You're fearful that something is going on. But what it did do is it did get a lot of folks saying, you know what, I'm not carrying no gun. I'm not going to do no bullshit. Just stay my ass out of the fucking way, because if I don't look suspicious, that's crazy. But it worked because that was people do drastic. That's what happens when you do drastic radical shit. Right there. That's the persuasion against radical change, because that's what all that shit was about, radical change, because nobody wanted to sit down and think about the soft power shit you could do. It was going there. We're kicking the fucking door in. We're going to make it happen. It's going to happen right now. Fuck it. We'll deal with the consequences later. That's your argument. Why incremental, slow change works better. We got 2 minutes left in the show. I want to thank y'all who listened today. I didn't want to necessarily bring in callers today, because I needed to get this out with having a debate joke. And I appreciate the folks who sent in comments via Facebook, because I'm glad that y'all engaged. Because these are important times. And everybody is right. We need health care. We need affordable education. We need something. Climate change needs to be addressed because it is real. But at the same time, we need to beat Trump. Because if we don't, none of that shit is going to happen, at least for another 20 or 30 years, because we're going to be so busy. Let's figure out how we're going to stop canceling each other and work together regardless of who the nominee ends up being. And winning for America. This is Scott Smith. This is Down South and Dirty. And we're out.